Take your Wellingtons off, children, and Mammy will tell you a pleasant story.
Good evening, I'm Kevin Factor, and this is Foraging Ahead. It's rare that I have a guest who is so captivating that I just shut up and let them talk. Tonight's guest is one of those rarities. Tom Krueger is a director and cinematographer who has worked in film and television for over 30 years. He got his start with Jim Jarmusch and John Lurie in Down by Law, shot countless music videos for MTV back in its heyday in the late 80s and early 90s, working with such musicians as Cypress Hill, R.E.M., U2, Joni Mitchell, and even Bob Dylan. We'll get to a couple of those stories, but tonight, Tom talks mostly about creativity, divine dissatisfaction, work, the film industry, and about how growing up in Berkeley, California in the 70s, without a father, shaped his life and his career. Tom Krueger.
What's the difference between a director and a director of photography?
Sometimes they're both. I do both at the same time, and the difference being one is the ultimate, a decision maker in the process, and the one with the sort of overall vision. And the cinematographer's job is just to do the shooting of it, the photography, mm-hmm. and support the film in the way that the cinematographer can, and the way that the photography can, and whatever's appropriate. And so really the director it's up to the director to somehow infuse all of the departments with whatever the overall concept is and whatever it is, the big picture story. And their job is basically to kind of drive or herd, is a better word, all these characters and department heads and everybody, to kind of herd them all in the right direction. And it's quite it's a great overall skill to have, requires so many different people skills, and yet you don't necessarily have to have any of them really well. You don't have to know any of them. You just have to know how to inspire those that are around you and get them all to do their best work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big part of being a director, is being a cheerleader, being able to communicate your vision mm-hmm. to them, and then it's sort of like your only currency, I think, as a director, is your ability to see it.
Mm-hmm.
And if whatever's happening, and it can get pretty chaotic, like insanely chaotic.
Really?
The process of making a film is overload. I mean, no one has the amount of RAM necessary to keep all those balls in the air and going. And the only thing you have to be able to hold on to is your ability to see what's happening in front of the lens, and is that right for this?
Mm-hmm.
Are they getting it? And if they're not, then you have to try to steer it mm-hmm. in a way. And then there's this another, at a certain point, you have to just, you're not going to control it completely, but you're going to hopefully be able to corral it in a way that in a great direction, where everybody's feeding off of you and it and the story and mm-hmm. the experience. And I'm a firm believer in, like, the muses and the spirits, and they, if you're open and you're listening, they are handing you stuff all day long.
Mm.
And I'm a big believer in that, and I could just give you endless examples of just being aware,
mm-hmm.
just listening,
mm.
and being open for business. Mm-hmm. They'll come, mm. and they'll give you stuff constantly.
Mm.
And all you have to do is just keep taking it.
Mm. Could you give me an example?
All right, I'll give you what I think is one of my better examples of this. So, the one and only feature film that I wrote, directed, produced, I did practically everything on it,
uh-huh.
and it was such a labor of love. I paid for it, and I And I did it with all my friends in Louisiana. So mm-hmm. it was started out as I made a film that was called DeepOnHogMountain.com. You can go watch it. And it's got its own, it's a short film, 30 minutes long. It cost me $3,000, and I made it with my friends. And it's a cult classic movie in the old time bluegrassy music world. And it's the actors in the movie are all stars in the bluegrassy old timey. Dirk Powell is the star of it. Riley Bogus. These are all like heroes of old time. And it was fantastic. We just had more fun. The Carolina Chocolate Drops are in it. It's a lot of fun. It's just a spoof comedy. It was me holding a camera, and if there was someone next to me, I'd give them the boom pole, you know, and that was it. No lighting, no nothing, no dolly, no tripod. It was just this fun little short film, and I had so much fun doing it, and it was such a success that I thought, I'm going to do this again, but a feature. I'm going to do 90 minutes of this. I think I can do it. So $3,000 was 30 minutes, $9,000, 90 minutes.
Right.
And of course,
and probably economy of scale, you could probably get it in for $7.
Oh, boy, was I wrong about that. And but I carried on, and I had a script, and the script was like an old idea, and I took my friends that I knew in Louisiana and Lafayette. They're not actors, but they're musicians and just super funny, great people. And that was a great start. And I wrote it for them. I rewrote it for them. But it was a movie about this guy that gets out of jail, and he's just a ne'er-do-well and always trying to be somebody, but he never measures up. And he's got this big idea of doing like sexual kind of inadequacy website, you know, basically like penis enlargers. You know, it all came from like getting emails all the time in mm-hmm. a certain period where it was all about penis enlargers, and I don't know how they knew, but it was, I was getting,
I think pretty much they needed to know that you were a male and that was a major insecurity.
Somehow.
Yeah.
But I thought, who does this? Like, who?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Who does this? And I thought, well, somebody who's, like, kind of trying to scam people. Like, and I thought, okay, there's this guy. And he's doing this. He's trying to make it big, you know, as fast as he can out of jail. And he borrows some money to get this done. And then he's got this idea, and he's gonna try to become an internet sensation. And that he's going to go viral, and people are all going to flock to his website, and then he's going to make a killing, and so the idea was he was going to go over in Niagara Falls in a giant like dildo type barrel with the website painted on the side of this thing, and it was going to create a big stir, and so to speak,
mm-hmm.
and a big smash. And,
yeah, so and he was trying to penetrate the market.
He was trying to penetrate. But so that's exactly what was happening, is that I realized that the jokes were one, you know, once you make it once, it's not that funny anymore. And I was basing a whole movie on
yeah.
that, and it just wasn't.
Well, it depends on what your target audience. If your target audience is 12-year-olds, fart, poop, penis, all those jokes, they'll take you far. But...
Well, it had to do with preying on people's fear of inadequacy.
Yeah, of course.
And so I thought, even at that level, it was working.
Mm.
But it wasn't that pivotal external plot point was not cutting it. You know, it was funny for a minute, and then I would get those emails, and I don't think I was alone in getting them, and I just, it's, you know, inspired me and blah, blah, blah. But it was really just a dumb idea that I didn't take very far until I had all my friends and I was going to be able to make it for $10,000. And like,
right.
just whatever, who cares? I just want to work with my friends
yeah,
and
sure.
make stuff. And so I went for it. But then here I am gearing up. I've got all my friends cash. We're going for it. Everything's happening. And I just realized, like, this isn't enough.
Mm.
This isn't good enough.
Mm.
And I'm like, okay, sit down here and figure something out that's better.
Huh.
And then the phone rings, and it's my doctor, mm-hmm. my MD doctor in Louisiana, and she's calling, and her office is calling to say, we know that you have, like, some allergy questions, and we want, we've got a... Would you like to come in? It's like, I am, you know, in full swing pre-production, like, I've got a huge thing on my plate. I'm not going to... Well, what's involved? You know, well, we have an 11 o'clock tomorrow. It'll take an hour at the most. And, you know, and I thought, all right, screw it. I'll go. So I go to the meeting. I mean, to my appointment at the doctor's office the next morning. And they sit down in there, and they shuffle me into some room, and they put me across from this nurse practitioner woman, and she puts my hand on this sort of weird cradle. It's like a metal inverted glove print. You know, it's like with all these different sensors, and you put your hand on it. And I thought, okay, this is interesting. And then she just starts asking me all these questions. What is this? What's that? You know, what do you do? What do you eat? La, 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 la. And she's just going on and on and on and on. And then, meanwhile, this machine is just going through my body. It's doing something. I don't know what. And after an hour of questions and this thing, like, sending, like, resonating through my body via my hand, she prints out this long thing. Like, she knows everything about me now. She knows that I have certain types of heavy metals in my body. She knows which lumbars are, you know, going bad. She knows my vitamins. She knows everything about me. And they have a lot of supplements that are going to cure me. And I walk to the front, and I'm like, okay, you want me to, first of all, this was $150 to get this process, you know, and you want me to pay that, and you want me to now buy about $300 worth of supplements. And I was like, well, first of all, I'm starting to get annoyed here that I've already wasted precious time. And like, I'm going to do a little bit more research, thanks. I'm not going to buy the supplements right now. Oh, okay, all right. You know, and I pay the $150 and I walk out of there. And I try to get back to work. I'm determined to find out what this thing is. Zytec. And I go online and I read Zytec. It's the founder is now like in exile because he's using a technology called galvanic skin response, which is basically a lie detector.
Uh-huh.
And it's only licensed to do biofeedback for people who have migraines. Basically, it's a biofeedback thing. And then I look on the website, and the only beta testing on this thing was on the Russian army. I mean, the Red Army in China.
Right.
And I'm like, all right. Fuck. I was so pissed off.
Right.
This is my MD doctor. This isn't like some...
This is, yeah. This, is, that's like something to lose your license over.
Oh, yeah. And I'm like pissed. And I thought, you know what? Oh, my God. This is it. Like, thank you. The music, they just handed me, the phone rang right at the moment and this is it. It's this alternative medicine. The mm-hmm. guy gets out of prison. Mm-hmm. He gets a license for this Zytec thing, and he's going to reinvent himself as a doctor of alternative
mm-hmm.
medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And then he ends up getting his family involved and borrowing money, and of course nothing works out as planned, and chaos ensues, and you know, he goes down in flames, but it's still trying to make a sensation.
Sure, and it's still feeding on people's sense of inadequacy. What's wrong with me?
Yes.
Why am I miserable?
Absolutely.
What? And it must be this or must be that. Oh, you got heavy metals, or you got this, or you're too bilious. We need to bleed you.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
It's basically medieval.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
And in the film, I turned it into urine analysis. Like, they can find all this out through urine analysis and galvanic skin response. So it's kind of like the multi. I went for it in many regards, and the film is called You're in Charge, like you are in charge, but you know you're in charge.
Oh.
And yeah, I couldn't help it.
No, I'm with you there.
But that's a great, to me, that's like the quintessential example of the muses are handing things all day long.
Right, right. Well, you just have to be, like you said, you have to be receptive, you have to be open, and you also have to have a certain amount of stamina, because it can be exhausting.
Well, then there's people like Tom Waits who finally realized, you know, he was saying it was exhausting getting signs from the muses all day long, and finally he was like, that's a great idea. Come back tomorrow when I'm open for business between 9 and 2. And that's when he says, puts out this shingle and says, you know, I'm ready. I'm listening now.
Well, most creative people, or I should say most creative people, writers.
Yeah.
Stephen King's great book on writing. I don't know if you've read that.
I know about it, but I haven't read it.
He said it, and a lot of other writers say it's just like, make an appointment with your muse.
Yes.
Every day.
Yes.
This time, this place.
Yes.
And be there.
Yes.
Right? And then go. Then leave.
Yep.
Yeah. And your muse will find you. Like, you'll just, and whether you actually believe in that or not, but it's, you know, habits. It's your habits of mind. It's openness. But yeah, to walk around all day, just wired to the universe, it's just got to be exhausting. I feel like.
I guess, but I'm like, you know, now I am trying more and more to do that, and I don't think it needs to be exhausting. I think it can be invigorating.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of becoming of the school that.
I could be wrong.
I want this to be the case, and I want to be able to, like, you know, my imagination. I don't want my imagination and that to be some sort of thing that I do on the side to imagine. I want to live in this imagination and like that become my primary mode of
I mean marvelous. I'm speaking like personally, like I you know, after a while it's exhausting, you know. I mean, and it's scary too, being open. I mean, it's
that's the exhausting part.
Is the fear or what?
The fear.
Yeah.
Like you're thinking this isn't good enough, and oh god, you know. I mean, I sit in front of my computer for days and weeks doing nothing, and I don't even like to say this. I'm going to say it now, but I do my best to not negatively reinforce the process. Even because I feel like there's a little child inside us that doesn't know the difference between what we're saying lightheartedly and what we're saying like totally passion and our deepest truth. It doesn't know the difference. And so if I sit here and I'm like, you know, I hate to sit in front of my computer, that solitary act of sitting, it is painful and exhausting and blah, blah, blah. And there I said it. Now, normally I would not even say that because that little kid inside me hears that and goes, oh, we hate to be in front of that computer. And I just feel like it's not, it doesn't help. And the same goes true with my professional career, which is I shoot and direct and shoot television commercials to pay for my creative habits and free time. I'm very blessed to have that. And if I really wanted to, I could find a million things that wrong with it. You know, in terms of the you can hear me hesitating to let these words cross my lips, which is that, you know, if I wanted to, I could pick it apart that as a career choice and a way to make money to be that kind of a cog in the capitalist system. Blah, 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 blah. rather than choosing to think that that too is a gift from the muses and these spirits or whatever you want to call them that are out there that are saying, here's this thing. It's not going to be enough to make you lose yourself in it. It never will be. You can hone your craft,
mm-hmm.
and it pays you enough to have a lot of free time and even make a good living when it's going well. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, it's gratitude. It comes down to gratitude.
Absolutely.
And if you're not grateful, you're never going to be satisfied.
Well, I might not be satisfied ever. I probably won't ever be satisfied.
Well, then that's what's wrong.
Well, but it's like in the words of Martha Graham in her letter to Agnes DeMille. This is something my friend's mother gave me when I was 19. I'm going to even recite it here because I've been reading it for so many decades.
Oh, yeah.
And basically in this letter, she's writing to her choreographer buddy, and she says, Martha says, Agnes, there is a life force, a quickening, an energy that moves through you into action. And because there's only one of you in all of time, that expression is unique. And if you block it, it will not exist. It will be lost. And it's not your business to judge it or to compare it to others or to determine its worth. It's only your business to keep that channel open and flowing through you. Okay, so I got, and there's one more paragraph which I'm going to get to in a minute. I got that when I was 19, along with the following paragraph. But that first paragraph, there's only one of me in all of time, and therefore my expression is unique. And, I mean, that carried me from Berkeley to New York at 20 years old. Thinking I had to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then
at that same age, a lot of smart questioning young people get Ayn Rand.
Oh, I bet. Oh, I got that too.
And
I read The Fountainhead.
And that's a spark for them.
Yeah.
Yeah, but carry on.
Sure. This was the big spark
for me. I like this better.
Well, here's the best part of it. And then I'm telling you, it's only the last few years since making that movie, and especially since making the movie You're in Charge, which was a success in for what it was and what it was, but I learned a lot. And here's the second paragraph that she wrote. She said, because for us, for artists, there's only divine dissatisfaction, the blessed unrest that makes us keep doing it. It makes us keep going. It's what makes us different than the others. And I'm butchering that part, but essentially what she's saying is that the divine dissatisfaction, the fact that you're never going to be fully happy, it's just kind of a curse of an artist, but it's what makes you do it again. Like, I know I made so many mistakes on that movie, but I'm, rather than walking away from filmmaking, I'm just dying to do it again. I wish it wasn't such a Herculean effort to make movies. Like, why did I pick the most expensive art form there is, pretty much, to go out there and make films that then ultimately live, if you're lucky, in the cloud on a folder in a disc that's on a shelf, or in the back of a computer somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not necessarily that satisfying, and yet I still have to keep doing it. And music is the same.
Mm.
Like, I just can't wait to do it again, to keep doing it, because I'm going to do it better. I'm not going to make the same mistakes that I made the last time.
Yeah.
Divine dissatisfaction.
If you're just joining me, this is Kevin Factor in Foraging Ahead, and my interview with filmmaker Tom Kruger. In this next section, Tom talks a little bit about his surrogate father, Lowell Bergman, the journalist, and his sister, Lisa Kruger, who is also a filmmaker. Is it an accident that both you and your sister, who is a quite well-known screenwriter,
and director,
mm-hmm. Are both in this industry?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, it's a coincidence. We came from a very fractured childhood. You know, my dad ran away with his secretary when I was five. You know, and Lisa was older, we then kind of, you know, she lived with friends, and my mom was, I was the youngest of four, you know, and she's moves to Berkeley and becomes a hippie, and, you know, in her communes, and, you know, in that kind of lifestyle, and, you know, we were on our own, total feral kids, mm. you know, on our own, and I got my friend in the eighth grade, his stepfather, this is like Berkeley in the 70s, you know, his stepfather is Lowell Bergman. And Lowell Bergman is a pretty famous investigative journalist, and he was, you know, he's won countless Pulitzers and stuff. And he was portrayed by Al Pacino in The Insider with Russell Crowe. And he was the journalist that broke the story about the tobacco industry, mm-hmm. and he got the executive, Russell Crowe, Wygant, to break. And then the network abandoned him. And they didn't want to mess with the tobacco industry, so they just pulled the story. And here was a guy who ruined his life, literally, just to come out and clear his conscience and say what... It's like saying the sky is blue. But anyway, point being that Lowell Bergman is my mentor and really my surrogate father.
Huh.
And I recognized early on, one of the blessings about not having a dad in your life is that you learn to turn men into your dad and create father figures along the way, mm-hmm. and I got to be very skilled at that, and it wasn't from the time of like 5 to 17, they weren't good guys, you know, basically speaking. You know, any guy that's willing to be any father figure that's willing to take on a kid, generally speaking, you know, has like, you know, ulterior motives, or they're just you know, they're con artists or scammers or whatever. I mean, believe me, I could just go on, drug dealers, whatever, the crime, all the stuff that was going on in Berkeley in the 70s, and father figures that are willing to, like, actually take a kid under their wing. You know, mm-hmm. Especially at that time, most together adults are not really, don't have time for kids, you know?
Right.
So... Lowell Bergman was the first one in my life, really. I mean, not entirely the first one, but the first major one that actually was like, you know, come live with us. I was 16, and I moved in with his family.
Really?
Yeah. And then he got me working on a show for ABC. He had me. I was a PA. I flew in a helicopter. I was helping the camera department. And I was like, okay, this guy is my ticket out of here. And I'm living on my own at 16. I moved out right when I turned 16. Then I'm a junior in high school. I get scarlet fever, and I just said, "Screw it, man! I can't. I'm not. I'm working. I'm trying to finish. I've got 2 years of high school left. Like, this is absurd. And I've got scarlet fever, and I just missed a month of class.
Mm-hmm.
I'm done." So I dropped out of high school.
Oh wow.
Dropped out of high school, and I went and went to junior college. I took my GED and went straight to junior college and studied journalism. And then I just was like, Lowell Bergman, he's my guy, he's my ticket, he's what I want to do, this is what I want. I want to be flying in those helicopters, I want to be doing this. And so I began to, like, you know, paint his house and refinish his floors and help him install burglar alarm systems. And he's like Mike Wallace's producer at 60 Minutes. Like, he's a heavyweight in journalism and documentaries. And then he would try to pay me. And I'd be like, nope, I wouldn't let him pay me for all this construction work I'm doing, everything. I didn't need the money. But So I would just work for him for free because I knew he was going to be the one that got me out of there. And sure enough, he got me. One phone call had me in the IA, the union, as a loader. And another phone call had me trained as a camera assistant. And then next thing you know, I'm working on 60 Minutes as a film loader at 19. And I'm in the union. You know, I'm in the union at 19. I still live in Berkeley. I didn't even know what the union was. And it cost me $2,000 to get in it at the time. And I was like, okay.
Where'd you get the money?
I got the money.
I hear you. Yeah.
And so I just ran with that and that was my, and then I just did the same thing. I moved to New York at 20, and I just kept picking out my mentors. You know, like, what can I do? Can I work for free? What do you want? What do you want? What can I do? What can I do? You know, you just hammer these guys. And they just, and I'm very blessed and lucky, you mm-hmm. know, that I was able to open doors, you know, a lot of privilege, you know, in that, even mm-hmm. though I was a street kid,
mm-hmm.
I was lucky enough to be able to, like, you know, get a lot of doors open to me, and I walked through them. I just put myself in the whitewater rapids of the film industry.
Mm-hmm.
And Lisa went the other way. You know, Lisa went, like, she went to Berkeley. I mean, she was still also, you know, kind of feral in her own way, in her own much more together way. And then she moved to Paris and went to study cinema with all the Cahiers du Cinéma and the Sorbonne and, like, you know, ended up living with one of them, you know, and she went the hardcore intellectual road to filmmaking. I went the scrappy road. But we met, then she went to New York and she said, if you can get to New York with a van, I can get you work. In 1985. And I just bought a van, drove across the country, and rolled into New York City in 1985 at 20 with a pager and a van. I'm in the union. And I just, then it just, you know, kept going from there.
Wow.
Yeah. So we did come together, like, you know, but I had moved to L.A. to try to work as a camera assistant, but the unions were so locked up there that even if you were in the union, you couldn't work there.
Hmm.
They had a roster systems, and it's like they'd have to exhaust A roster, then B roster, then C roster, and once they exhausted C roster, then they could pick nephews and sons and stuff, and they could go outside the union. So just because I was in the union from San Francisco, Berkeley, where there was no roster, there was no way I was going to be working in New York. Mm. I mean, in L.A. Mm. So after 3 months of trying, I packed up and moved to New York, and then we came together again, and I worked, my first job was on Down by Law.
No way.
And I was...
Did people confuse you for Tom Waits?
No. I mostly worked with Jim as his assistant in New York, and John Lurie's assistant in New York. Making the score and all that, you know, and helping with the edit and doing what Jim's PA work, you know, whatever. I moved them from one apartment to another and, you know, whatever they needed. And if they'd be off shooting, I'd be doing some menial skill, you know, task that they needed done.
Huh.
He needed done. Or whatever they needed. Whatever they needed, I would do it for the film. And the funny thing is that when it came time to crediting me, if you watch Down by Law.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I've seen it a couple times, yeah.
And at the end, I did everything. So I had no real role. I mean, I did whatever needed to get done. And so the first, it's just a special thanks, Tom, the first special thanks. Which is kind of ironic, but it was okay. I played every role, you know.
Uh-huh.
But I didn't play any specific role.
Mm-hmm. And then you parlayed that, or...
Yeah, and it's really funny, like, if I was to, you know, just look back on inspiration and acting on inspiration as a young person, and I'm still doing it now, hopefully, but I remember lying on my bed in L.A., trying to make it in my little apartment in Venice, trying to get involved in cinema and film in some way, no way, not getting through at all, and reading an article about Stranger Than Paradise and, like, Esther Balint and John Lurie and Jim Jarmusch and all these people that were making these cool art films in New York. And I mean, I had probably just seen Desperately Seeking Susan and everything. I just, like, New York just seemed like the coolest place in the world. And these are the coolest people at the heart of the coolest thing going on. And within 3 months, I'm working on Down by Law, and now I'm best friends with them all.
Oh, yeah.
I ended up shooting John Lurie's Fishing with John series. And I shot Jim Jarmusch's movie Gimme Danger that just came out a couple of years ago, and, like, best friends with Esther. You know, it just makes me laugh that there I was at the magazine as a 20-year-old, and I just bought a van and drove across the country with a pager, and I was right there. You just have to throw yourself right in the thick of what it is. Like, just get next to it.
Mm.
If I was to give any kid some advice, say, what is your biggest dream when you're, like, looking in magazines or the internet or whatever? And just go get right next to it and keep banging on that door, because you're going to get swept. The door, they're going to sweep. Someone's going to come by and reach out and grab you and throw you in the boat.
Mm-hmm.
And you're on. And it's so much harder to sort of be stuck in an eddy somewhere, you know. Right? Yeah. Just go where the river's rushing.
Mm-hmm.
Jump in there.
Yeah. Yeah. No, the mentor-mentee relationship is as important, I think, to the mentor as it is to the mentee.
Which is where I am now, you know.
Yeah.
And you're absolutely right. I'm having to transition from looking for father figures to acknowledging the fact that I've got a...
That you're a father figure now.
I'm a father figure now for some of these kids. And you can see it on their face. You can see it in their eyes. Mm-hmm. When they're like, I'm listening. And they're not trying to tell you that they know better than you, which is like 3/4 of people out there, you know. Oof. Kids. They're going to try to prove something to you, but you can see the other one is like, okay, you know, what can I learn from you?
Yeah.
And it's inspiring. You want to teach that kid.
You need to have a hunger, you know.
Yeah.
You need to have a hunger.
Well, and that hunger, like, okay, so, you know, even now I'm trying to untangle the baggage of what has made me, what made me so ambitious. Like, why did I even need to go,
like,
to New York?
Why you and not somebody else, you know? I'm sure you, as you were, you know, a street kid, there were a lot of other street kids that you hung out with and knew. But what did you, like, what is it that you had that they didn't have, or...
I had a lot of blessing, and then, you know, of just being in the right place at the right time, I guess. Putting myself in the right place at the right time. But also, I had those few skills which I recognized, which was how to turn a man into my dad.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that I gained because I didn't have a dad, really.
Mm-hmm.
And then this need to be lovable. And I know that's very unhealthy. And it's not unusual, but, like, I felt like I didn't measure up. I felt like I wasn't a lovable person.
Really?
Yeah.
I find you incredibly lovable.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. I think you're quite attractive. But
It's the hair.
But no, what I mean by that is that why did my dad leave me? Why did he abandon me?
Because he was a schmuck.
Well, he had his, now I realize, like, he just had his own baggage, and he was just, yeah. I mean, I have compassion for him now.
Yeah, well, that's the best, that's good.
But for my whole life, I thought it was me, you know, like, for my whole life.
And it doesn't make a difference if you tell a kid, it's not you, it's not you, it's not you. The kid's going to say, yeah, what do you know, it is me. Because by necessarily, you know, you're... Children are narcissistic. I mean, that's just
yeah, right.
You know, that's
exactly.
And
exactly.
And you need to fill that.
Yeah.
So did you reconcile with him at some point later in your life?
Yeah, and he admitted that he, you know, had his own. He was sorry for what happened and all that. But it was like, I'm just gonna say, it was worse than just running off with your secretary. It was she then went about proving to him that he had done the right thing and that all his kids were tramps. And from the former family, four of us, mm-hmm. and she was especially like me, kind of, and my brother. We got the we really got it worse than my sisters. They kind of managed somehow to navigate it. And her name was Cheryl, and she went about. She had a son my age, mm-hmm. but wasn't my dad's, and so she really wanted. I mean, she was out there ruthlessly trying to make my dad embrace her son as the rightful heir, and the other ones as tramps. It's like quintessential stepmother shit, and I had to deal with that with her, and my dad was not strong enough to kind of fight her. He loved her, and he wanted her, and, you know, and he did what she wanted. He gave into it. So I would have... when we would go visit him a couple times a year for birthdays and Christmas, it was like going. It was like the worst kind of audition.
Oof.
You know, dressing up. I mean, it'd take us days to turn from hippies into, you know, preppies.
Right.
And we couldn't do it. And my mom quietly enjoyed the process, you know, of us going over there, like looking like tramps, you know, like mm-hmm. hippie kids. And my dad just, like, couldn't stand it. But in the end, all of this made me feel like I wasn't worthy. You know, I wasn't love. I didn't measure up. I wasn't good enough, and I wasn't lovable. And so I think that deep down, when I saw Lowell Bergman and I saw, you know, television and the film industry, and I was like, that is the fast track to becoming lovable. You know, look at the stars. Look at the people.
The fast track becoming lovable. Well, I mean, you know, that's probably the story with a lot of people in that industry, right?
Well, I feel like I'm still trying to untangle
mm-hmm.
that. You know, I'm like, and now in my life, like.
Like, well, you seem perfectly comfortable talking about it, and
I'm zeroing in on it, you know, and I've been aware of this thing for a while, you know, this sort of, because I think that it's led to another incapacitating thing that we all often suffer from, which is this terrible fear of failure, because failure, especially if you look at it from a primal standpoint, failure is like. Equals you fail, you get abandoned, you get kicked out of the tribe, and you get eaten by saber-toothed tigers. I mean, that's basically what, for most of our evolution,
yeah.
failure has meant.
Yeah.
Has meant banishment. And so you, even now on the scale of, like, whether or not we're going to have a house and a career and a family and all the things that we have all are default kind of purposes that we all think were the things we're supposed to be doing. And then we try to accomplish that, or else we're out, you know. And so I think my back is still a barometer for when I'm stressed, when I'm fearing failure, when I'm afraid that I'm gonna, you know, seize up on a job or something, on a film job. I mean, it doesn't happen any. There was a period though, from like 23 to 33, which I was having chronic back pain.
Huh.
And I realized at that moment, I actually read a book called Healing Back Pain by this Dr. John Sarno. And it was like, I essentially cried for about 3 days straight. And then I said, I do not have a back problem. I have been doing this. I've been carrying it around like a sponge for all my anxiety and fear of failure. And my fear of being abandoned, and I'm letting go of that, and it went away.
Huh.
Gone, just like that. It just took a book, to read a book and cure yourself. And I went to every quackologist that you could think of. Well, you know, I mean, I could tell you stories about the kind of therapies that we undertake and to try to. I think that's where my inadequacy, you know, concept came from, you know.
This is Kevin Factor. If you're just joining me, you're listening to Foraging Ahead and my conversation with Tom Kruger, cinematographer and director. Next, Tom talks a little bit about working with John Lurie and Jim Jarmusch, and he shares his tale of shooting a music video with
Bob Dylan. What was it like?
Dylan.
What? Are you laughing?
I was just laughing.
What?
John Lurie is like a genius. I really think he's a genius, and he's like he just comes out of him all the time. His paintings, he's just like a very gifted person, and it was just really. I'm trying to think. It was fantastic working with him. You asked me about Jim Jarmusch, and I just remember like. You know, the privilege of starting off working with him and watching him do the music for Down by Law. My job was basically to carry, you know, I'd be at the edit suite and I would videotape, like on some really old tube camera or whatever, off of the Steinbeck of Steinbeck of editing table. And I would videotape the movie, Down by Law, and then I would carry this. I would go to John's like little tenement apartment and carry this TV set down this East Third, which is like one block was the Hell's Angels block,
right?
And then the next block was where they would. It was right across from his apartment on Third between Bowery and Second Avenue was the halfway house for Rikers Island. So they would bus. These buses of convicts in mm-hmm. and just drop them there for
right.
the day.
So some kid walking down the street with a TV in his hands was totally normal.
Yeah, and a VCR and a big TV, and I'm carrying in it, and all these like you know
yeah.
convicts are just watching me, and then I load it up into John's third floor walk up, and then I would set it up and plug in the VCR and the TV set and. And then just sit back and watch. And he would just sit on the floor and start watching the scenes of, you know, Tom and all, you know, them going through the bayou on the boats. And he starts playing the saxophone, you know, and it's just coming to life in the most incredible way. I just remember just being that little 20-year-old watching that taking place and how impactful it was.
What a privilege to be able to experience that at that age.
Oh yeah, I know. And in that time, and at that time, you know, New York downtown, the East Village in the 1985 was like a war zone in the best way. You know, it was the best. I mean, it was dangerous and scary and crazy.
Yeah.
But there was art and abandoned buildings. You could take a building for a, you know, if you had a motorcycle chain and a padlock, you could homestead big buildings down there, or you could. You know, or if you had a dollar, you could go officially buy the building from the city for $1. But no one was doing that. They would just homestead them or whatever. And that was the rest of them are just shells, abandoned.
Yeah, yeah. No, I remember. I mean, I remember. I grew up in Long Island.
Yeah.
I was born in Brooklyn, grew up in Long Island. I remember the city
over.
In the 80s. Yeah. Well, so John Lurie.
Well, I just you brought up that.
Yeah, yeah.
I just remember, yeah. you know, going from a kid who's like reading him in the magazine, you know, and just thinking like, wow. And the next thing you know, you're watching this whole movie come to life, and
mm-hmm.
and it was just a blessing. And then that he brought me in and I shot like a commercial for The Voice of Chunk, which was a Lounge Lizards album in 1989.
Oh, you did the Lounge Lizards.
I did a commercial for the Lounge Lizards, and I would go to all their shows. I mean, I was crazy about them, you know. But I was in there, and then John was like, "Come do this TV show with me, Fishing with John," and that was fantastic. I mean, I had already moved back to LA and was now like working in the music video business. I was so lucky. This is like the kind of time. What was that? What was the Malcolm Gladwell book about? It might not be Bling.
Turning Point.
Yes, where it's just about being in the right. It's luck.
Well, it's luck, but again, it's the you know chance favors a prepared mind.
Right.
It's, yeah. It's, so you had the skills. You had the and you know if you didn't have and think of how many people were there that didn't have your skills and your chutzpah that missed. So you were just,
I was, and also, like, my ability to, you know, again, just ingratiate myself, you know, in these scenes, because I think I had the fact that my dad ran away with the secretary kind of gave me a certain skill set.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you got a leg up, you know?
Yeah.
May everybody be so lucky.
May everybody be so lucky. I mean, my sister always says, like, you know, making lemonade out of bitter lemons, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I really am thankful for that. And I was just I mean, I could just tell you. So I moved to LA in 1990. I bought a camp. So here it's like crazy. I'm 24 years old. I've been a camera assistant now for 4 years in New York, loading film and pulling focus and. Then at 24, I borrow a bunch of money from a bank and I buy a $50,000 camera package and then bam, that was the smartest thing I ever did. It took super crazy balls to do it, but it was the best thing I ever did. I next thing you know, I'm swept into the shooting of the heyday of music videos. MTV is at its peak.
Right.
Every band had to have a couple music videos, no matter how they were signed. They had videos, and they were spending anywhere from between $20,000 and $200,000 for these things.
Right.
And I had a camera package, and I moved to LA like with my camera package, and just got swept into that. And I was shooting one or two videos a week for 3 years.
Wow.
And
who were some of the people that you shot for?
I shot music videos for David Bowie, Cypress Hill, Public Enemy, Stevie Wonder. I almost killed him. I told you that story. Bruce Springsteen, U2, REM. I could just keep going down the list. Joni Mitchell, 4 videos for Joni Mitchell. Emmylou Harris, you know, directed and shot for her, and Bob Dylan, a couple videos for him. I directed one, shot one for him.
Yeah, what was it like working with him?
Weird. Great, but weird. Like, he's a funny story. If I was going to give you a funny story, I got a call to shoot a close-up of Bob Dylan. That's all it's going to be. Like, he had made a movie. And they'd done the music for a movie called Gods and Generals. And it was like a big, I think it was like a Ted Turner movie.
Oh, it was like it was an adaptation of a Shaara book.
Yes.
Like Gettysburg,
yes.
One of those
Civil War thing.
Yeah.
Gods and Generals. And so they had bought a song from him, and they were going to really pursue it, you know. And so I get this call, will I shoot a close-up of him? Or, you know, just one performance take, and they're going to cut it into the movie footage. I was like, yes, I'll do that. And then before you know it, I had written this whole treatment. I was like, he's right down in Virginia near Richmond. I'm going to get all these Civil War reenactors. They had a $100,000 budget. I wrote up this whole treatment, and it was fantastic. And the idea was that Bob and his band, and he's on horseback, and we shot it in a Civil War cemetery there. And then in the back of the cemetery, in the dump of the cemetery, we created a Civil War encampment and got all these reenactors and horses. And Bob was, you know, we put him in a, he looked amazing with his long overcoat and hat and beard and wig and everything. I mean, he looked fantastic. And he loved it. He was just in heaven. And I said all the right things to get him to want to do this video, because he's a big buff of that, you know. So I remember, you know, I hadn't met him yet, but here we're on the day of the shoot, and there's his bus, you know, and they're like, okay, come meet Bob. And I remember, you know, the door of the bus opens, and I climb on the bus, and I look just as he's putting on a leather glove, you know, and he puts on the glove, and then he turns around to me, and, you know, because we're gonna shake hands, and he doesn't want to touch my hand.
Huh.
So I get like the most limp gloved shake, you know, like, okay, you know. And so now we got that out of the way, and then we're just sitting there, and it's like, yeah, you know, I see, I want to do, like in this, you know, I was watching Will Penny the other day, this movie, and in the movie you see the bad guys, and they run into this shed, and then they're in the shed, they're hiding out in the shed, and all of a sudden you kind of see this hand drop a smoke bomb in the chimney, and then the place fills with smoke, and the bad guys come out, and the camera tilts up, and on top of the shack is Will Penny, and bam, bam, he kills him. And I'm like, okay. And I'm like, yeah, that's what I want. Like, you mean like a reveal? Like a reveal, yeah. Like a reveal shot. You know, like, so basically, like, where you kind of tilt up and you sort of see the boots, and you see, like, this reveal, and then there is Bob, you know, like,
right,
coming into this Civil War camp, you know. And so, good, you know, and I did it, and I put him on horseback, you know.
Could he ride a horse?
No, but he had somebody pulling it. You know, I mean, he was on it, and right, his bandmates, and they were all the band were in it, and everybody got in costume. We really went for it. It was great. It was a great set. It's called Beyond Green Mountain.
Hmm.
God, I can't believe Beyond Green Mountain. And so I cut this whole great video for it.
Mm-hmm.
But then I remember, so we have our meeting, and at the end of the meeting, like, he puts, I could tell the meeting's about to be over, you know, when the glove gets put back on.
Uh-huh.
Like, okay, I'm about to shake his hand. You know, it comes the hand, you know, okay, see you out there. And then I went out into the set and got it ready, and he came out a little while later, and we made, you know, shot for a few hours, and but it was great. I mean, it was, and he only said one word. I was like, I had the playback going, like, okay, sing anytime you want, you know, and he wouldn't sing to the song. So the song is playing, but he's not singing.
He's not singing in the video.
No, he didn't want to. You know, he doesn't like to lip sync. You know.
Yeah, fair enough.
Fair enough. And so we, but then there's this one line where he reaches down. Like, so the concept of the video is that him and his kin and his band and his people are coming to get the body of his kin.
Mm.
And so they ride into the Civil War camp, and they're doing, like, the daguerreotypes, you know, of the soldiers. And we had this whole set, and all the Civil War reenactors down there are incredible. And they just love, they love Dylan, the whole thing. I mean, it was a huge deal for them. And so he comes walking in, and then he climbs off his horse, and they're doing some rudimentary surgery next to him. But there's his dead kin, and they stand over the body, and the guy's, you know, dead, and Bob just reaches down, and he just says, "My merciful friend," you know, as he whispers in the cadaver's ear.